Not Quite Right features discussions that are unfiltered and uncensored and may include themes that are inappropriate for younger listeners. Also, I swear a lot.
Something doesn't seem quite right.
Welcome to Not Quite Right. My name is Ed. And this is the fourth of a series of interviews that Amanda and I recorded at the Words on the Waves Writers Festival this year. This time, we're speaking with Quentin McDermott. Quentin is an investigative journalist and author of Meadows Law, which tells the story of Kathleen Folbig, who was once called the most hated woman in Australia after being wrongfully convicted of killing all four of her children. We spoke with Quentin about Kathleen's story and how, 20 years later, she was finally able to clear her name. So, here is our discussion with Quentin McDermott. We're here at Words in the Waves with Quentin McDermott, and you've just come off the panel called Australia's Most Hated Woman. Tell us about the panel.
Well, I was on the panel, it was just me and Sonia Orchard, fellow author, who's also appearing here at Words on the Waves, in her own right, so to speak. And we had a fascinating discussion. I enjoyed it very much. I love the vibe here, so chilled. But it was actually quite an intense discussion as well, because the story that we were talking about, which is the story of the case of Kathleen Folbig, is quite an intense one. As you know, it's the story of a mother who lost four of her children in succession and was then accused of killing them all and spent 20 years in prison and was then finally pardoned and released and acquitted 2 years ago in 2023. So her story is extraordinary, but it's very, very intense as well.
Yeah, and you must have spent some time with her to get the details of this story. And I'm interested to know what's she like. I can't imagine what she's been through, and, you know, to come out the other side, it's a very unique experience, to say the least.
Yes, that's right. I met her when she was in prison to start with in, I think it was 2017. And, you know, contrary to the idea that had been propagated in the media that she was a monster, you know, I found her to be actually very warm, very sociable, a lovely sense of humour, but also very stoical about her own situation.
You must imagine, yeah.
And I mean, it is hard in a way to imagine how she remained sane being in prison, you know, for 20 years. But I think, as obviously happens in prisons, you kind of build up relationships with other inmates and friends and so on. And it's interesting, I produced an episode of Australian Story on the ABC about her case. And when we were filming outside the prison she was in, I spoke to a prison officer who was escorting us around, and I said to him, you know, what do you guys feel about her? And he said, well, we all think she's innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting, and I think that would have made things easier for her inside, because, of course, when she first went into prison, she was treated as, you know, the lowest of the low.
Absolutely, yeah.
And just reviled by the other prisoners. But I think gradually, and particularly when some in the media, including Australian stories, started to raise doubts about her convictions, I think the mood inside would have changed for her. And certainly when there were two petitions lodged on her behalf, and when the second petition was lodged, which was signed or endorsed by three Nobel laureates, I think at that point, her fellow inmates started to realize that, wow, you know, this probably is an enormous miscarriage of justice.
And then it's just the opposite situation, right? You go from being the most hated person to now, my God, like to have gone through what you've gone through and still be here is impressive. It's just a complete reversal of opinion, I suppose.
It is a reversal of opinion. And I think that certainly that second petition signed by or endorsed by three Nobel laureates certainly changed public opinion radically. But of course, even now, even after she's been acquitted, you know, there are still people out there who refuse to believe it. And so I don't think she would ever feel entirely safe and secure. But, you know, she's living a life, of course, outside the institution of prison. Now she's surrounded by incredibly close friends, you know, who look out for her 24 hours a day. And so, you know, hopefully she'll be fine. But of course, you know, she lives with the memory of everything that happened.
And it wasn't just the false imprisonment. And obviously that's 20 years of her life that's gone, but that's on top of a tragedy. multiple tragedies and also that public perception, the idea of being known as someone who obviously you're not, that's a huge thing that she has to live with and obviously continues to live with. But what do you think was the turning point that changed everything to lead to her exoneration?
Well, we talked about this in the session with the panel, and you know, I think there were several kind of incremental turning points, if you like. So one of them undoubtedly was in 2011, a legal academic called Emma Cunliffe published a book called Murder, Medicine and Motherhood. And essentially what she did in that book is she deconstructed the evidence that was presented at her trial, and she came to the conclusion that the trial had frankly misrepresented the truth, and that in fact she was innocent. And then after that, there were lawyers in Newcastle who kind of picked up the ball and ran with it, and students, funnily enough, at Newcastle University, just up the road, who put a lot of back-breaking research into re-examining the case. And then eventually, in 2015, a petition was lodged on her behalf calling for a judicial inquiry. And 3 years after that, we broadcast Our Australian Story in 2018. And that was a turning point because 9 days after Our Australian Story went to air, the then Attorney General, Mark Speakman, got up and announced a judicial inquiry. And that was probably, that was in one sense the turning point, but the first inquiry was unsuccessful for her. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that there was a second inquiry, a second petition, and then a second inquiry. And that was really when, obviously, it all turned around in her favour.
I think it's interesting that journalism has always played a part in justice, right? But in recent times, we see, for example, these hugely popular podcasts with the true crime stories, and they tend to be focused on justice from the perspective of getting someone in jail. So I'm just interested, too, in like how this, the public perception, first of all, got her there, but then how it can build in someone's favour as well to get that justice. Because, of course, there would be many people in jail who just don't have that exposure.
Yes.
To find their justice.
Look, I mean, I think you've touched on a lot of questions there. I think there was, you know, a real kind of thread of misogyny running through this case, which was that, you know, in terms of her trial, for example, that as a mother, she was held to standards of motherhood, which no woman should be held to. And in terms of parenting, that her husband, Craig, was not held to. But, you know, how did we get to that point? Well, then, you know, after she was convicted, she was completely demonized by the media. I mean, she really was portrayed as a kind of evil monster. And I think, you know, this is similar to what happened in the case of Lindy Chamberlain. You know, when Lindy Chamberlain was wrongly accused and wrongly convicted of killing her baby, Azaria, she was held up to be, you know, a monster, and her whole kind of demeanor at trial was kind of picked up on by the media as being, you know, she's an evil, you know, she's the demeanor of an evil woman. And exactly the same thing happened with Kathy.
Well, it's all that false evidence building. I remember, you know, with Lindy Chamberlain, the black dress of Azaria's, I don't think it's even black, right? It's dark blue or something like that, that all these little bits of evidence, and it doesn't matter that they're not true. It just becomes part of the broader narrative that people latch onto to help explain in a way that makes them understand.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I wanted to ask as well, is going back to like to the very beginning and the trial and the conviction, looking back now and saying it's great that she's been exonerated, but what were the factors that actually led that initial miscarriage of justice? Was it, in your opinion, was it related to the media circus narrative of, you know, the mob mentality, or was it, you know, we also hear stories of the judicial or maybe police laziness. I'm not sure how much of that is real, of like wanting just to get the conviction without worrying too much about whether the factual basis is there or not?
Well, look, my book is called Meadows Law, and it's called Meadows Law for a reason, which is that when Kathy went to trial in 2003 and in the years before that, there was this theory known colloquially as Meadows Law, which was invented essentially by a British paediatrician called Professor Sir Roy Meadow. And his theory was that, you know, one death of an infant in a family is tragic, two is suspicious, and three is homicide unless proven otherwise. And the uniquely unlucky situation, if you like, that Kathy found herself in was that when her fourth child, Laura, died, this Meadows Law theory was prevalent in 1999. And I believe that one of the reasons the police pursued her is because they were well aware of the Meadows Law theory, and there were medical experts out there who espoused this theory, who shouldn't have, but who did. And this theory had helped to send several mothers in the UK to jail. And so the police mounted this investigation, which essentially, I think, took as its starting point that because four infants had died in her family, that one of the parents, and almost certainly her, must have been guilty. Mm. Now, one of the things I discovered in writing this book was that the police carried out secret recordings of Kathy and Craig, her husband, in their home. And the content of one of these recordings is truly astounding. It's Craig coming down early one morning and talking to his wife and saying, all night I've been thinking, maybe I killed the kids.
Oh, wow.
And not only that, he then goes on to explain in detail in this secret recording how he could have killed each of them in turn, and not only that, but what his motive would have been, because their relationship was very rocky in between the deaths, not surprisingly. Mm. And they'd separated on a couple of occasions. And he said in this secret recording, you know, my motive was basically to kind of get you back, you know, to get attention. But the interesting thing is, from the question of, well, even with Meadows Law, who do you blame, the mother or the father? They never seriously believed that Craig could have done it. They only believed that she could have done it.
Mm.
And indeed, the secret recording was, almost all of it was suppressed at her trial. And later on, it was suppressed in total at the first inquiry. And it was only by the time of the second inquiry that it was finally kind of brought forward as an exhibit.
Fascinating, because at an inquiry, I mean, we understand the rules of evidence in court, but to not even have it in an inquiry is just seems outrageous to me.
Well, I think it's shameful. It was submitted. I'm not trying to overly claim credit for this, but I drew her lawyer's attention to this transcript. Mm-hmm. And the transcript, the police transcripts of all these conversations were never questioned in court, the accuracy of them. And so her legal team submitted this transcript to the first inquiry, and it was then completely redacted.
Mm.
And I think that is shameful.
Mm.
And when Justice Blanche, or former Justice Reginald Blanche, who was in charge of the first inquiry, wrote his report, not only did he conclude that the evidence he had heard reinforced her guilt at the first inquiry, but he also said that, you know, the evidence appeared to show that the four children had been smothered and there was no other possible explanation or no other possible perpetrator other than Kathleen. Mm. But he'd had in front of him this transcript of Craig saying, all night I've been thinking maybe I killed the kids.
So has Craig had an opportunity to respond to that evidence?
Well, so here's the sad part of the story, is that Craig died last year.
Yeah.
And what I will say is this, that over the years I tried on several occasions to reach out to Craig to see if he would be prepared to talk about the case, and he never was.
Mm.
His family in general are still, as I understand it, convinced that she murdered all four of her children.
Mm.
And indeed, when she was finally acquitted, legally acquitted in December 2023, Craig's lawyer came out with a statement saying, you know, he still believes that she is guilty as charged. And ludicrously, in my opinion, said, you know, the judges did the wrong thing in acquitting her. They should have ordered a retrial. And then the horrible irony is that about 3 months later, Craig passed away. And so, and many other of the key witnesses are no longer with us. And so had the judges ordered a retrial, you know, 20 years after her original trial, I don't think it wouldn't have been feasible for a proper trial to have been carried out. So they made the right decision.
And so he was convinced that she was guilty, right? Was that the case as well during the relationship?
No. And in fact, what's very interesting, I think, about Craig's part in this whole story, and I hate to speak ill of the dead, but what is interesting is that he started off, even after the police began their investigation after Laura's death, the fourth child, he started off by staunchly defending her. And in fact, in some of the telephone conversations which were recorded secretly by the police, he mocks the lead investigator, the lead detective, Bernie Ryan.
Mm.
And he's absolutely 100% on her side. And it's only later on, after they split up that his kind of tone changed. And he was, I've spoken to on, I'm as sure as I can be, on several occasions by Bernie Ryan, the lead detective. And he admitted in court, Craig admitted in court, because he gave evidence against his wife, that Bernie Ryan, the detective, had helped to convince him that it wasn't only, to put it in his words, housing commission women who murder their children, but that someone like Kathy might have done so. And so I think he was actually quite impressionable.
Yeah.
The other thing is that at a certain point in 2001, 2 years before the trial, they arrested Craig, and they told him that they were arresting him on the grounds that, you know, he might be charged with obstructing the investigation. And I think that had a big effect on him. And then they then recorded an interview with him immediately afterwards where he was suddenly making all these accusations against his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And so I believe that he was an extremely unreliable witness. But the incremental effect of the evidence being given by some of the medical witnesses and Craig, and then the entries that she had written in her diaries, which the prosecution presented as if they were virtual admissions of guilt, all of that built up to persuade the jury that, yes, indeed, she had done what she was accused of.
I'm really interested, too, because, of course, this is a fascinating story, but what drives you to write about it? Like, you've obviously committed a huge amount of time, not just for the book, but for the Australian story as well. So what motivates you to, I guess, pursue this justice?
Well, one way I can answer this is by saying this, that I used to work at Four Corners, and as a reporter at Four Corners, way back in 2011, I reported a story on Gordon Wood and Caroline Byrne, and I don't know if you recall that story, but that was the story of this man, Gordon Wood, who was a chauffeur to Rene Rivkin, and, you know, very tall and handsome, you know, chiseled features and all this kind of stuff. And the accusation was that he had killed his then girlfriend, Caroline Byrne, by throwing her off the cliff at the Gap in Sydney. And the prosecutor, the senior Crown prosecutor who prosecuted that case, was a man called Mark Tedeschi. And when we did our Four Corners report about it, we pointed to several extraordinary kind of failures in the police investigation and questionable evidence that had been presented at his trial. And following his appeal, the judges came back and, first of all, they acquitted Gordon Wood. And secondly, they were highly critical of the senior Crown prosecutor and the way he had conducted that trial. And I then spoke to an acquaintance of mine who is a champion bridge player who is much more obsessed than I am with all the cases that have been run by Mark Tedeschi. And he said to me, you know, there are all these other cases you should look at, and one of them is Kathleen Falby, because it was Mark Tedeschi who had prosecuted her. And certainly when I started to look at the case, the common factor between the Falby case and the Gordon Wood case was that both cases were based on entirely circumstantial evidence. Mm. And there was no actual forensic evidence linking the alleged perpetrators with the bodies of those who had died. And so I was fascinated by that. And then I read an enormous report that was attached to the first petition in 2015 on Kathleen's behalf, which was written by this very eminent Victorian forensic pathologist, Professor Stephen Cordner. And in that report, he said, not only was there no forensic evidence that she had smothered any of the children, but there was also positive forensic evidence pointing to natural causes of death. And in particular, in Laura's case, because Laura, when she died, was suffering from a condition called myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart muscle. And so, you know, armed with that, I thought, well, hang on, is this another miscarriage of justice case? But in 2016, 2017, when I started looking at it, no one else really was interested. There were some journalists who had touched on the case. Tara Brown from 60 Minutes, to her credit, had reported a story about it back in 2012. But, you know, the overall public view at that point was, you know, she did it, she's a monster, and she can rot in.
And that's enough. That's all.
Rot in prison.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it's fascinating, the power of storytelling. You know, like, we're here at a writer's festival talking about words, but, you know, we think, I guess, of words as connection and so on, but words can be incredibly powerful in justice and in swaying public opinion, obviously. So, I mean, you've been doing that your whole career. So you've got this power to influence people. Do you feel powerful?
not as powerful as I'd like to be.
Yeah.
but I'd like to flip that, actually, and say, because I think you raise a really, really significant point, the power of words. In her case, the power of words was used and misinterpreted at her trial in an incredibly impactful way.
In her journals?
Yes, in her journals. So you know, she had written a number of remarks in her journals, which, you know, at first sight were certainly troubling, but which were appropriated by the prosecution as virtual admissions of guilt. So that was the negative power of those words, and it was only 20 years later, at the second inquiry into her case, that a whole raft of psychologists and psychiatrists came forward who had read her diaries right the way through, all of whom, every single one, said there is nothing incriminating in these diaries, in anything she's written. And so I think that's incredibly telling, and it was, of course, most unfortunate for her. But in terms of my storytelling, well, I hope that, you know, people who read the book will believe by the end of the book that they've kind of heard the whole story from both sides. And, you know, I hope that the power of it will be to evoke, I suppose, a sense of kind of injustice that it took so much effort by so many people to kind of get this over the line. One of the things I talked about in the panel earlier was the extraordinary kind of accumulation of efforts by an enormous team of different people, without whom, in almost every case, at every juncture, you know, she wouldn't be out of prison now. Yeah. Okay, so for example, her lawyers worked thousands of hours pro bono on her behalf. Some of the scientists worked pro bono for hundreds of hours on her behalf. There were, you know, philanthropists kind of donating money to move the case along, and so on and so forth. And a whole selection of highly committed people, scientists from overseas. You know, in the end, there were scientists from Denmark, from, you know, the United States, from Australia and elsewhere, who kind of banded together to actually help get this over the line and to, you know, to reveal the science that in the end helped to release her.
I'm just talking to Hugh McKay about the power of cooperation, and yes, sounds like that's a perfect example of it.
It is. And look, I've been saying for some time, I see a kind of vein of misogyny that stretches from Lindy Chamberlain through Kathleen Folbig to Lucy Letby in the UK. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. There are some striking similarities, in my opinion, between the Lucy Letby case, which I'm sure you know about.
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
And Kathy's case. So, for example, it took an international team of experts in Lucy Letby's case to raise serious and significant doubts about the medical evidence that was presented at Lucy's trial. Mm. And I'm not sitting here saying, you know, she's innocent, but what I am saying is, and also the statistical evidence in Kathy's case was completely wrong-headed and erroneous. There was one expert in the United States who wrote a report saying that the chances of all four children dying from natural causes was 1 in a trillion, which is absurd. Mm-hmm. But there were similar statistical errors and misleading evidence given statistically in Lucy Letby's case. And so, you know, there are some, it's interesting. And in both those cases, and of course in Lindy Chamberlain's case, it's the mother or the caregiver in Lucy's case who are kind of scapegoated, you know, rightly or wrongly, for the deaths of these infants.
Mm, and I guess it's, for many people, it's that truth being stranger than fiction sort of thing. So Kathleen's case, we can't fathom how four children could die. It seems so, like, so too big of a coincidence. And so one explanation is that they were killed. But of course, one other logical explanation is that there's a genetic, you know, abnormality that would apply to that family. And then, of course, in Lucy Letby's case, and she was the nurse, the pediatric nurse, that, you know, okay, one explanation is that she killed all these children in her care, and the other is that they were critically ill anyway, and that's the type of children that she was working with every single day. So, yeah, I mean, I, of course, don't profess to know enough about any of these cases at all. But
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and I think in Lucy Letby's case, one of the potential explanations is that she was scapegoated by more senior doctors and consultants who were not themselves providing the standard of care necessary to keep all of these children alive. And I'm not saying that some of them wouldn't have died anyway, but certainly the environment and the standard of care at the hospital has come into question.
Mm.
But she was an easy target because she was present at, obviously she was present at all of the deaths of the infants for which she was convicted, but she wasn't present at the deaths of other infants who also died. And that's one of the ways in which the statistics were skewed against her.
So one of the things I'm finding interesting is just thinking about the timing here, right? And you're drawing a line of, I guess, systemic sexism. And do you think things have changed? Like, could we have a case play out the same way today as we did have 20 years ago? Or have we moved a little bit forward to a point where if this happened today, her husband would also, for example, receive some of the scrutiny that didn't happen 20 years ago?
Well, you would like to think so. You would hope so. I mean, what has absolutely changed, no question, is for example, is genetics.
Mm.
So in 2003, genetics was in its infancy. And, you know, the tests that were carried out that identified the cardiac genetic mutation in Kathy and her two daughters, Sarah and Laura, would not have been possible. They would not have, they could not have occurred in 2003. So to that extent, I think the value of scientific evidence has certainly advanced exponentially, mm-hmm. if you like. But then that's not the end of the story, because then you have to ensure that the right scientific and medical experts come to give evidence, mm-hmm. give expert evidence at trials. And it's very interesting in Kathy's case, they did come and give evidence at the second inquiry, but the senior counsel who were carrying out the inquiry were advised every day by the Australian Academy of Science. And the Australian Academy of Science advised them. They didn't always take the Academy's advice, and quite rightly so, but the Academy advised them on the best experts in the field, and they also advised them on the types of questions that the inquiry could ask of those witnesses. So there was, in the end, actually a very broad range of scientific medical experts at the second inquiry, some of whom didn't believe that the genetic mutation was necessarily the cause of the deaths of the two girls. But I think it's that whole process of, I think things have advanced in that sense. But in another sense, they haven't, because, you know, what Kathy's case shows is that it's only because, you know, that there was this enormous team of different experts and journalists and others who were kind of advocating on her behalf that actually helped to get her case over the line. Most men or women who were kind of languishing in jail who may have suffered a miscarriage of justice, they don't have a team like that to call on. But I think that, the business about it, this being a kind of enormous effort is absolutely critical by lots of different people, you know, and lobbyists and others.
You got to take a little bit of credit, surely.
Well, I'll just say this. I take credit for producing the Australian story, which I think helped to trigger the first inquiry. What I don't take credit for, but was incredibly fortuitous, is that the day after our story went to air, a young man called Dave Wallace, who is a lawyer, but is also trained in genetics, which is pretty impressive, he watched the program, and I didn't know him then, and he had been following the Folby case for a long time and believed that there might actually be genetic causes of death for some or all of the children. And he contacted this Spanish immunogeneticist, Professor Carola Vinuesa, who he knew and he'd studied under. And he persuaded her to get involved. And in the event, it was Carola Vinuesa, probably more than any of the other scientists, who drove this case forward on Kathy's behalf. And so, you know, it's actually yet another example of kind of sliding doors moment. I mean, I take credit for getting the Australian story out. I'm happy to do that. And I'm very happy that it helped to trigger the first inquiry. But actually, you know, in terms of the science, there was this kind of sliding door moment. If Dave Wallace hadn't watched it, if he hadn't got in touch with Carola Vinuesa, the whole genetic inquiry most probably wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And that might have led to a very different outcome.
Well, again, power of cooperation.
That's right. And luck as well. Mm-hmm. The sound of it. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. It's a fascinating story, and our listeners can read all about it in Meadows Law. So thank you for joining us, Quentin.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
This has been a special presentation of the Not Quite Right podcast in collaboration with Words on the Waves Writers Festival. Check the show notes for more information about Words on the Waves and the books mentioned in this episode. If you're new to the podcast, please join us again for our regular episodes where we talk about media, culture, and the art of writing.
Something doesn't seem quite right.